This is the Simon Dell Show, where we take a deep dive into some of the week's most notable business and marketing stories and interview high-performing business leaders and marketing professionals to find out their lessons for success.
Consumer behaviour is to go in there and be inspired, to learn, to understand about a brand, to keep its brand awareness. Like, you just can't beat the data. Like, you cannot beat the ability to pick exactly what you need. And it's bloody underpriced. I was a drug dealer.
Welcome to the Simon Dell Show, episode number 26. Thank you very much for tuning in and listening to us again. This week, the spin cycle, Eddie is back. She is no longer poodling about Brisbane on a moped with Tony Robbins on the back. She is back and we are discussing the demise of the classic Ford and Holdens as the brand of choice for the New South Wales Police Service. And then we kind of segue into a argument that I was in on Facebook the other day about autonomous vehicles. Intel are supplying 8 million chips to power level 4 and 5 autonomous vehicles to a European car manufacturer. That was announced a couple of days ago, this being the 22nd of May. So that was quite interesting because of the rise of autonomous cars that should be rolling out in 2021. And just for anybody that doesn't know, level 1, if anyone wants to know what the levels are on autonomous vehicles, they are as such. Level 0 is warnings only, may momentarily intervene, no sustained control. Level 1 is hands-on, so the driver must have hands-on at all times. The system and the driver share control of the car. Level 2, autonomous car, is a hands-off, which bizarrely means that the driver must keep their hands on the wheel. That doesn't make much sense, but what it says is the autonomous system will drive the car, but the driver must keep hands on the wheel. That's level 2, also known as the hands-off. Level 3 means the eyes off the road. The driver can text or watch a movie if they want. So you can sit in your car and go to work and watch the latest episode of Game of Thrones. Level 4 is the mind off, which means the driver can actually have a nap. Wouldn't that be fantastic to have a nap in the back of your car while you're on the way to something? And level 5, which is the top level of autonomous driving, means that a steering wheel is optional. And that's pretty much as described. Doesn't need a steering wheel. So there you go. So Intel are supplying chips to a European car manufacturer to power level 4 or level 5 autonomous cars. So that's where we get into that conversation. So if you've got some opinions on that, I'd love to hear them as well, because I'm a big fan of autonomous technology and so on. On the show, we have the interview today we have with a gentleman by the name of Jules Lund, who is a broadcaster and also the CEO of a website called tribegroup.co. It is an influencer platform. It's a really, really innovative and exciting influencer platform. I know we've spoken about influencer platforms in the past. He has got a fantastic story and quite an emotional story as well. So it is a quite powerful episode where he talks about some of the things he's done in the past, some of his mentors in the past, and talks about his experience in radio and TV and all those kind of things, and how he believes that all of these platforms from advertising and marketing are all changing. So Jules is very, very interesting and worth listening to. Aside from that, the usual notices, Gilberto, the podcast boss, go and see his website. It's in the show notes. Please go and give us a review and rating as well. That would be fantastic on iTunes. We've got quite a few, but the more the merrier. And finally, if you want to get in contact with me, if you've got something to say, if you want to get into an argument about autonomous cars, I'm all up for that. Please come and find me at I Am Simon Dell on Twitter and LinkedIn, or email me at simon@simondell.com. And of course, you can find the podcast Instagram, the Simon Dell Show on Instagram. So please come and follow us there. Other than that, let's jump straight in to the spin cycle and welcome Eddie back. Welcome once again to another edition of the spin cycle, and back this week by popular demand, or
sort of average demand.
Thank you very much for having me. Oh.
The barley of co-hosts, in that it's drunk and rowdy, it is Professor Dr. Edwina Luck from QUT.
Cheering. Yeah, I can hear it.
And joining her, as usual, the Butlins of co-hosts.
Wow. Australians won't understand that.
No, but most
they don't know what you're talking about.
The Butlins of
for
co-hosts.
All our Australian listeners, is a very, very posh. Very, very posh.
Shithole.
It is. It put the shit into shithole.
Yeah.
It put the shithole into shithole.
Yeah. Patrick Condren from Channel 7. Round of applause.
And in this country, it's pronounced barley, not belly.
Barley, that's what I said.
Barley.
You did not. I don't know what you said, but it wasn't barley.
That's the problem.
Hey, I must say, guys, I loved last week's show.
Well, you weren't on it. Oh,
I know.
Did I say that out loud?
Yeah, you did, but I read your mind as well.
I would have said the same thing. But
Wow.
There's a certain class and decorum that comes to the show when Kim's on it and when Eddie's not on it.
There was swearing last week.
Yeah, but it's classy swearing. It's how you say fuck, you know. Oh, fuck, like that. Like you're at a royal wedding and you've just tripped over, that kind of thing.
Oh, like that. Who was it that tried to high-five the policeman on the way into the church? Now, who was that? I saw that. Of course, the policeman didn't high-five her.
No, of course not. Don't get him started on the royal family.
No,
Eddie, talk
here.
About,
I, Eddie, I had an excess plan. Yes. Okay,
talk
so this is so exciting. Okay, so good to be back. I'm glad you missed me, Pat.
So, what was your name again?
Exactly. Times have changed for the New South Wales Police. And they actually did this back in 2016. But we have an end of an era on our hands now, because the amazing Ford Falcons and Holden Commodores that have served the police force for, probably 50 years that I can think of. Blimey. Actually, no, back to the late 70s. Probably later than that. Like, we've had V8 Commodores, we've had VH, we've had VR. And if you know your cars, you will know what I'm talking about. But these cars are being retired. And in July, we're going to see turbo diesel BMWs and V8 powered Chrysler sedans going to be rolled out. So this is really big branding news.
Yeah.
That's in New South Wales.
Yes.
It's been happening in Queensland for donkey's years.
What, the Holden and Fords being replaced?
Oh, God, yeah. I was following a Hyundai police car the other day. Oh, I absolutely.
Wasn't following you.
Well,
maybe yes, maybe no.
And what brand was it?
Hyundai. How many times have I got to say it?
Oh.
So they've been doing this in Toyota Corollas and, I mean, some of the, the V8 Interceptors, the last of the V8 Interceptors, quoting, you will both recall, Mad Max. They're still around. Like the highway patrol and the liveried highway patrol cars have still, the V8s. I think they're Holden, some of them. But certainly patrol cars have been of different makes and models for many a long year. Beg your pardon?
They'll be going out because Toyota Camry sedans have a lot of those brands, they're going to be going out, and a lot of these new brands are going to be coming in.
Do you think it's good for the brand to be a police car?
Absolutely.
I don't think people care.
No.
Really?
The main thing about the cop car is, provided the siren's in front of you chasing someone else, you don't care what sort of... what sort of a cop car it is. But I think these sorts of decisions these days, certainly my memory from when the government made this decision to head down this road in Queensland, it was a cost saving. So the coppers were told, instead of Holden and Ford just being able to expect to get millions of dollars, what you need to do is to use your fleet buying power to go out and say, but we can get that and we can get that. So it was nothing more than a cost saving measure.
Although it's not a cost saving now, because the BMWs are actually more expensive than the ones.
Did you say this was happening in New South Wales?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, each state has its own different police force.
Yes, railway, like everything. Yeah. So the nicest thing is that they have put this to market, and they have assessed over the last 3 years 17 different cars. So they haven't gone into this going blind, saying, well, you know, we need, you know, purpose-built cars, which of course they do, but they haven't gone, well, we're going with this brand over this brand. And as you guys know, and as listeners would know, Australia has not been making cars now for, well, a couple of years. So certainly Holden and Ford.
Yeah. Do you think the brand, the question I asked earlier was, does anyone care? The next question was, do you think the brand cares? Is this a brand statement that BMW can say, we are the cop car of New South Wales? Or do you think that's a selling point?
I've got to be honest, I've never seen any organisation trumpet that they were providing services to the police force. I'm just as you asked that question, I was thinking, you know, a whole lot of people say there was some kerfuffle a few years ago when a particular organisation, I think it was a mining company, sponsored some police cars in far western Queensland, and they put their branding on the police car.
Yeah.
So you were pulled over by the Queensland Police, sponsored by Feast Mining. But I don't have a memory of anyone saying, hey, come and buy our cars because we provide vehicles to the police force. Mm. I've got to tell you that a lot of people would be, I think, turned off. I don't think it would be a big winner for a brand.
Yeah. Do you think, on that note that you've just touched on there, Pat, do you think there's space on other emergency vehicles that we could advertise on? Like ambulances, for example.
Yeah, I think it's a really difficult area to do because, you know, I just can't see it. I think it's too, in terms of a public policy decision, because these are all taxpayer-funded things,
yeah.
I just think it's too difficult because they're providing an emergency service. I can't see, you know, the ambulance brought to you by,
by Maccas.
Well, or even by, BWS. So the police, the ambulance is responding to a fatal car accident, for example. Yeah, fire engines brought to you by Redhead Matches.
They'd have to pick their sponsors quite carefully, wouldn't they?
Yes.
So when I was in Dublin, I did get a laugh, and this was in my 20s. Oh, excuse me, you lived in London for years, excuse me.
Yes, I never bang on about it.
Oh, really?
Oh, no. God.
Oh, would you like a cup of tea?
Oh, God, I can't believe you just said that.
Yeah, anyway. Yeah.
That was a Trump-level lie, that was.
So my theory is, like Trump, if you say it forcefully enough, just plough over the opposition.
Nice.
Anyway,
so when
Eddie.
I was in Dublin, when I was in Dublin and I walked out of the Guinness Brewery because I'd been on a little tour, I got a very big, I had a very big chortle because the ambulance actually did have a sponsored by Guinness beer.
Wow.
Yeah, and I thought that's...
Only in Ireland.
Exactly.
Only in Ireland.
I know, but it's a good story.
On that note, because there was a little extension to this story, I read yesterday that Intel have agreed a deal to, I'll read it, Intel's autonomous vehicle division, Mobileye, has signed off a deal to provide self-driving technology to 8 million cars for a European automaker. The chip that is designed to power fully autonomous cars, which are level 4 or 5, there's level 0, 1, 2, 3, 4 and 5, and 4 and 5 basically mean you can have a nap in the back.
How many cars did you say they're going to make?
8 million. And they will be supplying those chips from 2021.
Hmm.
Wow. That space is changing so quickly. Absolutely phenomenally. And, kicked off by, I think, Tesla.
Assuming that European car manufacturer, because there aren't that many big European car manufacturers that could feasibly be taking 8 million chips, that would mean that, let's assume that's BMW, because BMW actually sold worldwide 2.2 million BMWs last year, which is a lot of BMWs.
you could link up with them, wouldn't you?
That's 3 years' time that you could see roughly. Let's say BMW just go for the entire amount that they're going to sell that year. They switch over to autonomous. That would be 2.2 million autonomous vehicles on the road in 2021. Now, assume it's not going to be that many, but even if it was 20% of their fleet, that's 400,000 autonomous vehicles on the road in 3 years' time, and autonomous vehicles that you can sleep in.
Yeah, it's great. But if they're building cars for police now, and they have been doing it in America and Europe as well, you know, they've got Wi-Fi, they've got digital radio, they've got, I mean, the police obviously have a lot more facilities that they want, facial recognition, all that sort of stuff. But yeah, if they've got this technology now that is working in police cars around the world, why wouldn't they just extend that into the digital, into the driverless car, which is...
There's not too many autonomous police cars driving around.
Well, no, but I think she's saying that all this other technology that's available,
Pat, the technology,
that you could have autonomous police cars in 3 years' time, which is a very good point.
Absolutely.
And, you know, especially in pursuit things, you know, pursuit situations.
Well, surely if they can create an autonomous vehicle, they can also create a vehicle that can be turned off remotely.
Well, absolutely. And that's one of the issues with cars being hacked and things like that.
I think, and presumably all those autonomous cars, would they be electric or would they be...
Well, yeah, absolutely. That's the other challenge as well, is that, you know, you can't imagine BMW starting to roll out a fleet of autonomous cars that are petrol, because who's going to go? Because then you're going to have somebody filling the bloody things up all the time.
That's right. It's autonomous when it's pulling into a service station.
And absolutely.
Then you've got the service station attendant coming out again, and we're back to where we started.
No, there's a long Pepper. You've got Pepper the robot.
There's a lot of the car parking companies, so the Wilsons of this world, are starting to realize that in 3 to 5 years' time, their income could be dramatically slashed because people aren't parking their cars anymore. Mm-hmm. Autonomous vehicle would drive you to work, you get out, and the autonomous vehicle would piss off, go back home again, and come and get you later on. Or it would go and pick someone else up because you've got a subscription to a pool of cars.
You rent it or deliver packages. Absolutely. Or it turns into something else.
What these big car park companies are starting to think is that they would start turning over their car parking spaces to converting them into autonomous charging stations. So the cars would wheel in there, charge themselves up for a couple of hours, and then off they go and pick somebody else up.
Alternatively, you could turn them into apartments.
Absolutely.
Yeah. They don't have a lot of window space, those car parks.
No, exactly. But from my point of view, the sooner the better. Bring it on, I say. Well, absolutely. Bring it on.
The argument I got in the other day was that people are going, people love driving cars. People like the sound of an engine. And I go, if you're stuck on the M1, you know, trying to get home after you've been to the beach, fuck that shit. If you could sit in the back and watch a movie while that's going on, you know, or have a sleep, or play a game of cards with everyone else in there, you know, it's...
Absolutely. Yeah. And how big a jump is it from autonomous vehicles to passenger drones? You know, that's the next big thing. I know that certainly some researchers have created a prototype of a drone that you can sit in.
Yeah.
And it'll fly you around.
I think Uber had a video out the other day where they were showing that they were going to convert roofs of tall buildings into like airports. Mm. So you would, you know, go to the top floor of the new Queensland Government building, jump in a drone, and it would take you somewhere.
Take you to where you needed to go.
You know, bring it on.
The sooner the better. The sooner the better.
Absolutely. You're going to have
people at Logan and people at Beenleigh who want to drive their homemade V8 interceptors because they like the sound of the engine.
Yeah.
Well, piss off and do that.
Yeah.
But for me, to get in and be able to go from home to work, later, because I can do the first half hour of my work sitting in the car, driving to work.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you know what? The next thing is that, and I've been reading about this for years actually, is that, you know, we've all got garages, whether it's a unit block or a home, and these spaces are going to be empty. So they're going to be converted into greeneries, into kitchens, into other
greeneries.
Yeah, like where you grow your own plants.
I've already got a kitchen.
No, but you'll be indoor.
Why wouldn't I put a home theatre out there?
Vertical gardening.
You'd
have a company. You'd have a company that would be able to roll into your garage and convert your garage from an empty space into an indoor vertical garden.
Absolutely.
So that you can grow whatever it is that you wanted and
sell to your neighbours. You know, like you give it away to your neighbours.
The indoor.
Why not put a soundproof room there so I don't have to listen to anyone else?
Well, that's. I'm sure your family would like to put you in that. Yes.
Wow, you've always got to turn it against me, haven't
anyway,
you?
Back. The final point I'll make is the reason I got into this autonomous vehicle conversation on Facebook the other day was my point that secondhand cars, the value of a secondhand car in 2021 that is petrol driven and non-autonomous is going to be virtually zero.
Absolutely.
It is now,
absolutely,
though, Simon.
Well, Volvo's phasing out petrol cars. Is it Volvo? I'm sure it's Volvo.
Yeah. Who is going to buy a secondhand car that's not autonomous and petrol driven in 2021? Nobody.
Exactly. Exactly.
And that's what I'm saying to people is if you're going to buy a car now, assume it to be worth fuck all in 3 years' time.
Yes, exactly. Absolutely, 100%. Exactly.
People arguing back. Anyway, guys, thank you very much.
You've got it. Oh, hang on. Sorry. Just
go
on.
Yeah, go for it.
Let me just have one thought on this. I think it would also lower the fatality rate on the roads.
Oh, without a doubt. Without a doubt.
You know, instead of my 15-year-old is turning 16 this year. He's going to get a learner's permit. You know, the year after he'll get a license, then he'll get a car. He's still going to school at that stage. If I could put him in an autonomous car and say, take him to school, that's going to lessen his chances of becoming, and he's going to be in that group of the most fatalities. That's going to increase his chances of surviving.
There's teenagers in LA, in some of the more richer, affluent families, who now are no longer learning to drive. Their parents get them an Uber, they put the Uber app on their phone and they say to them, whenever you need to go anywhere, whenever you need to be picked up, you get in an Uber. We know you're safe because it's because we know who the driver is. We know where you are at all times. So the next step is that's an autonomous vehicle and the kids are being ferried backwards and forwards without the parents needing to do it.
Mm. And I got to tell you, we're not affluent, but it's a temptation.
I do feel sorry for the Uber drivers, though, when autonomous cars do come in, because they're going to have to find a new job.
I think they know it was a short thing anyway.
Simon. Yeah.
Anyway, thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. Yeah, we are. Well, we can't sit here and talk all day, and Eddie's got back, and, you know, I think we all need to sit down and a cup of tea now she's returned. So.
Gin and tonic, mate.
Gin and tonic, or a hit from the bong. Anyway.
Promoting drug use.
I don't know.
I was just suggesting we would listen to some Cypress Hill. Anyway, thank you very much, guys. We will see you next week.
Bye.
Ciao.
I welcome to the show this week Jules Lund, who has a list of talents and accomplishments the length of my arm, including hosting Getaway, the Logies red carpet. He's done stuff on television, radio, digital. He's been on breakfast radio. Do you know what? People can look this stuff up.
But half of it's bullshit because half of it I wrote.
Oh,
you know,
well, mate.
I just make stuff up. I just created a Wikipedia page. I said that I cured cancer, that I know where Elvis is living. I figured exactly what's happening with the Bermuda Triangle. I mean, I'm claiming a lot of credit for things I haven't done.
Mate, if you haven't bullshitted on your LinkedIn profile, you are nobody. That's all I can say.
Exactly.
Do you know what the first thing that jumped out to me on this was? Graphic design. Can you design?
Well, to be honest, I'm about to spend this afternoon putting together a high-level mock for a creative agency. So Adam Ferrier is a consumer psychologist. He's also on the board of Tribe, which is my company, and he's a smart cookie. He's created Thinkabell, a company built on the combination of, I suppose, I think he calls it measured magic, but it's all around science and magic and marketing. And so he's got a brand, a beauty brand, who, you know, has a challenge and he thinks we can fix it. And so I have to visually articulate what is possible. And what I love about these guys is that, you know, they're courageous and they try new things. And I think that any brand that comes to them has a sense of faith and trust because they've won every known award, you know, individually before coming together for Thinkabell. So, so what I want to do is I've got a lot of thoughts, but it's pointless unless I can very clearly visually communicate that. And so this afternoon, I don't know how to use any graphic programs, and I build everything in Keynote.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Well, Keynote's quite a creative platform, isn't it?
I'd be a weapon if I knew Photoshop or Illustrator or like anything else. So I'm going to build these Insta story mocks using content and how to take still imagery and turn it into motion, like 15-second ads that sort of combine not only the image that a content creator generates, but also a testimonial with their profile pic that comes up, so that it's sort of authenticity, but packaged in a really highly engaging and high performing ad format, which is Insta stories, which no one really knows how to figure out, including myself. So I'll tell you in 5 hours.
It's as you've just said that there, it's kind of occurred to me that with all the things that have happened with social media in the past, let's say 10 years, I don't think people talk much about the barriers that have been reduced in terms of the ability to produce content. Because, I mean, if you didn't know all the Adobe programs 10 years ago, you were pretty much fucking hopeless, weren't you?
Yeah, well, to be honest, and that's where a company like Canva, you know, Melanie Perkins and Cliff, where those guys have hit, you know, they're in 190 countries and they're worth $1 billion, and it's democratizing design because of the skill needed to be able to use those programs that intimidate the shit out of me. Whereas you go into theirs and they've got millions of stock imagery, they've got plug and play, you add the fonts, you add the colors, and that's just powerful, powerful tech to give people power, you know, give people independence and agility where, you know, agencies can use that obviously to create mocks like I should be doing this afternoon. And then all the way down to small businesses being able to use that for all of their social media needs where they get I don't know if they do motion, I'll have to have a look, but there's other platforms for that. You plug in stuff and create them. But it's, like design, you know, like it's one thing just to have, like there's so many problems, there's so many bottlenecks with advertising today. And the first one is that 5 years ago, you only needed a handful of assets and you could run, you know, you only needed one still image and you could run a national billboard campaign. You only needed, a bit of video, which was your TVC. But now with digital advertising, considering everyone's staring at their phones, right, and you combine personalization, like the superpower of Google and Facebook, the gift of our generation is being able to target precise audiences, but you need precise messaging. And that's where the wheels fall off because advertisers haven't caught up. They need to go from a handful of images a year to needing hundreds, you know, every couple of months or every month. And who the fuck is going to produce all that? Because creative agencies they do low volume, high quality, stunning, award-winning content, right? But small businesses can't afford that because you need 100 pieces of content, right? And then you can't use stock image libraries because it's the antithesis of personalization. And then you can't sort of just scour the web to see who's just randomly taking stunning photos of your shampoo bottle so that you can ask to purchase it and put it in your marketing. Like there's actually no creative solution for content right now.
I do you know what? One of the things I'd written down, I've written three words here when I was thinking about the questions I was going to ask you, and I've written ad industry ? complacency. Do you think the success of these, the likes of the Canvas and what you're doing now as well, is due to
that complacency from the ad industry over all those years?
No, I just think consumer behavior shifted quick, social platforms shifted quick, and it's like trying to turn the Titanic.
Yeah.
So it's, I don't think it's complacency. I think it's moving really fucking fast. Mm. And I think that marketers, like you're 44, I'm 39, I think. And, you know, the point is, like, we and all the CMOs and all the C-suite, right, are our age, and they're making decisions, billion-dollar decisions, what to do with their marketing.
Yeah.
Like you and I, our purchasing behavior was influenced by TV and radio. And even though we understand social and digital, right, we were never, like, it doesn't have the same meaning to us that it has to millennials that have literally learnt about the world through their mobile, and all of their advertising has come through word of mouth, through influencer marketing, or it's come through you know, branded content on Facebook or however, right? But a ton of it hasn't been coming through TV and radio necessarily, right? So still heap, still got a power, right? But the reality is that they're not influenced as much by that. It doesn't mean as much. So right now we cannot help but have an disproportionate amount of value on TV and radio. It's what we know and we're comfortable. And we try to disrupt ourselves, but it's really hard to shift that paradigm. Like it's over 30 years. And so what's happening is customers have moved on. And the social platforms have created all these formats, right, that the customers are loving, engaging with, whether it's six-second ads, it's vertical video, Insta story, Snap, whatever, right, all of this stuff. So the platforms realize what are testing this stuff. The consumers start loving it. They're off in this bloody party all jumping around. And then the social platforms comes over to the advertiser and says, hey, do you want to come over here? You can pay to reach the eyeballs that I'm engaging. And then it all falls over because then the brand goes, yeah, I'd love to. And then the advertiser goes, yeah, all you have to do is this, 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 and this. And they go, what the fuck? You're telling me that every 6 weeks I need personalized content for every different brand persona, like every persona and customer journey that I have? Yeah, because it needs to be specific, because you can now reach a 22-year-old girl in Cronulla who's interested in fashion and fitness. Okay, so I need a piece of content just for them. Yes. How many of those personas you got? 15. And then so you get breadth, right? And then you go, that's all well and good, but the social platform then says in 6 weeks that all goes to shit. You know, it suffers from ad fatigue. So then personalization is nothing without volume. And then you get all that sorted. And then they go, well, that's just your static images. You also need vertical video and long form, and you need, you know, and then this is the problem we're in right now. Like you can't – where do you go to get that – variety and volume? And what I believe, and I reckon I'm probably too early for it, is that the fastest growing creative solution on the planet is customers.
Yeah.
It's your own customers.
Yeah.
So that's what I'm banking on, because I reckon they are the ones that can provide the variety and volume and are the experts in crafting thumb-stopping content in the formats that social platforms are innovating with. And who better to create content that customers love than the customers themselves?
It must scare the crap out of some of the corporates that you talk to in the first instance.
I don't know. Like, that's what Adam Ferrier says. Like, Adam says, oh, mate, it must scare the shit out of creative agencies. And I say, no, it shouldn't. In the same way that when we first started, we were talking about influencer marketing. And don't forget, PR agencies were influencer marketing before there was influencer marketing. They crafted this whole thing. Like, when I was a D-grade celebrity on TV and radio, like, they would send us shit daily for us to be able to talk about and spread and talk about on air and on radio, on TV. You know, like, that was influencer marketing. It was like, who are those opinion leaders? How do we get them to sample our product and spread the word, right, before there was social media? And so everyone said, oh, your platform's going to kill PR. And I was like, are you kidding me? Like, they should continue to do exactly what they do. What we provide is the volume around it. So creative agencies, it's not shifting to just 300 pieces of content for your Instagram and Facebook campaigns. It's that plus the TV and the billboards and all that. So creative agencies have to do exactly what they do. They craft that stunning content, right? And as Gray Worldwide, the CEO, Leo Raymond, said to me over at a big event in Athens, he's like, I'm a creative agency. It would scare my teams. But as I see it, it's like jazz. We start the beat, right? We create the brand tone. We get the creative. We nail that. So we start the beat, and then the customers and the creators then add their sound and then amplify the volume. So it's like, and we've done that. They do TVCs, and then they come to us and they put the TVC in the brief, and then you get 300 people doing what's happening in the TVC. So they're like hand delivering the mass marketing message, but they're personalizing it to their audience that they've crafted this unique dialect with over thousands of posts over 5 or 6 years now. And so it's doing all of it together. And if someone's intimidated, then they're missing the point that it's not a replacement. We need to add it.
I think there's a lot of PR, and having worked with some of these, there's a lot of PR agencies and PR people that are still scared of their own. You know, I've had PR people that work, their lifeblood is a spreadsheet full of their contacts, and that's how they exist. And I think they fear that that's going to stop being as relevant to their clients.
It shouldn't. I would be doing exactly that. And then off on the side, I'd use technology. Yeah. I'd go, here's my 20, and they're going to nail it. I'm going to spend some time. I'm going to craft this. And then here's 200, right? I don't have to speak to. And I put 10 grand over here, and then I put 10 grand over there. And now I go back to the client with hundreds of pieces of content and all these ways that they can repurpose it. All of this unbelievable sentiment analysis, you know, and all of this word of mouth, you know, it's absurd. You know, we should be, with the technology available, you should be surprising and delighting every client. You don't even have to say that you use the technology. Just say, I'll just go to my database. And you come back with 300 pieces and they go, in fact, that's a pretty good database.
You mentioned in there a couple of minutes ago, the 6-second ad. That's quite a new thing, isn't it?
Well, the point is that, you know, you scroll a news feed on a phone in 1.5 seconds.
Yeah.
Right? Now, static images don't catch your eye enough. And so Facebook talk about 0-second ads. If you haven't caught someone in the first second, you're not going to catch them, right?
Right.
And so we take, like, for instance, Unilever, they've done like 40-odd campaigns and, you know, for, you know, dozens of different brands across the globe with us. And they take content, still imagery, and then they just give it a Ken Burns effect. You know, that slow pan?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
A slow pan and then a bit of graphic comes up at the end. But just that, if you're scrolling your feed and there's a beautiful pic of, you know, for Omo, you know, it was all about sensitive moments. A beautiful pic of a mum and her child, and they're using Omo because it's, you know, it's sensitive and considerate to sensitive skin. Then, you know, you're seeing that image and it starts moving. You just lean in more. Like, it's as simple as that. Let's not overcomplicate it.
No.
And so it's, you know, there's a big push and everyone's freaking out. Shit, everyone wants video. They don't want video. Stop freaking out that you've got to get these departments and how much money do I have to spend and have a video strategy. Consumers.
I made a video for a dentist probably 2-3 months ago with a mate of mine for $500, 15 second. And it looked, by the end of it, it looked like it had been, it was a, you know, a half day shoot. You get the right people and you can produce some fantastic things.
Absolutely. And the key to that, even that frightens people because then they need, which they should use you, but, you know, like they should use you and let you take care of and pay. But my point is that for most of us, you don't need video. What everyone is craving is motion. Yeah. Motion is different to video. And as I say, taking a photo and slowly making it pan is motion. And Facebook talk about, you know, motion is the new filter. Over the last 12 months, you know, filters were amazing in terms of just polishing something up, just taking it, you know, doing something so simple like pressing a button and yet this thing just comes alive and just catches people off guard in a sea of static. And motion is that. So figuring out how to give things slow pans and then throwing it in is powerful. And so we've got an issue over the next few years, and I guarantee it'll change the second that the millennials hit the C-suite. You know, you've got billion-dollar contracts and budgets, you know, and say it's 70% on traditional, 30% on digital and social. Mate, that isn't going to trickle down over the next few years. Someone is going to change. They're just going to get into that role. And, you know, they're now 38, I think, the millennials, right? So the oldest millennials, mate, in the next few years, they're the C-suite.
Yeah.
And this thing will fucking flip. And when it flips, everyone's going to feel this pressure of like, where the hell is all this disposable content? I need 200 pieces of content over the next 2 weeks. I need to spit it out, and I need to run this stuff programmatically. Otherwise, we're paying millions of dollars on content that gets ignored because it's not personalized and it's not sophisticated, and it's gone tired. Like, it's gonna be huge, I reckon. I reckon influencer marketing will pale in significance to what I believe is the big category on the horizon, which is customer generated content. It's UGC, which is boring as hell, and it's been shit for years because it was a Nokia 6210 taking a photo at a footy stadium of your meat pie and uploading it to the Telstra microsite. You know, like, it was just UGC's been shit outside of travel industry, because people were taking away their big cameras and had the time, but everything else was garbage. Yeah. The big difference now is that people are armed with smartphones, and every smartphone manufacturer on the planet right now is racing each other, and the war will be won whoever releases the best creative tools. Like, if you look at the marketing of Huawei, Samsung, Pixel, and Apple, no one is talking about the camera and the phone anymore. No one's talking about the phone. They're all talking about the camera. And so all of their things is about investing in the creator, because the kids on the street have these creative tools the same time that the professionals will get them, and every, you know, AR will be the next, branded AR will be huge, and every, you know, app developer is currently going bananas since Tim Cook released, you know, the AR kit in Apple. So all of these apps are about to come flying out, where you can get Bacardi, put it in front of your AR app, and the whole thing comes alive, and the bat logo flies off, and then they're going to need 300 versions of people interacting with that. You know, it's all well and good to do the tech, but who's going to then interact? And so, and then the second thing is why UGC is about to blow up is because not only do they have the tech, which is the smartphone, they have the talent. 7 years worth that they've just graduated from the University of Instagram. It's turned a billion people nearly, and that would be the next announcement, a billion people, right, everyday people, into not only photographers, but because everyone's crafting their own personal brand on Instagram, they're fucking marketers. They, like, you look at the content that comes through from punters who have never thought or read a brief, you know, and these guys look at the color tones of the packaging of the Lynx bottle, and they do flat lays and stuff with the same color tones. Like, no one even mentions it. They just get it.
I, do you know what? There's about 1,000 questions I could ask you now, and I'm going to come back to the influencer stuff, because obviously that's where where your skill set and your, you know, the destination for you is at the moment. I just want to get a bit more of an example, a little bit more of a history about you personally. The question I ask everyone on this first question I normally ask everybody is, what was your first job? When was the first time somebody paid you money to do something?
I was a drug dealer.
that's the first time that's been mentioned.
So I'd go up to John Button Chemist in Ashburton, right, and I'd go in there with my BMX, and they would give me a bag of drugs that I had to drop off to the old grannies, and they gave me $2 every night, and I'd ride around Ashburton in Melbourne trafficking these drug drops.
so completely legal drugs.
Yeah.
Ah, thank God. Thank God for that. I thought we might have to cut this bit out.
Well, you need clickbait, don't you? I was thinking of the headline for you.
Jules London, drug dealer, right? Yeah, exactly. That's going to be my. That's going to be how I'm going to push it on Twitter.
Go for it.
Well, how old were you then? I was going to say at BMX, that must have been quite young. Yeah,
I reckon I would be about 9 or 10. But right. I was always, it's funny, you know, as people say, I think it was Steve Jobs' address at Harvard or Stanford or whatever, talking about joining the dots. You can't join them looking forward. You can only join them. But, you know, like I was entrepreneurial. Yeah. Like I was always hustling. So what we would do is like, you know, I'd be selling old newspapers at my parents' parties because my parents just had parties galore. And I was just thinking, this is just a captive audience of drunks. And so I'd just go and pick up all the papers and they had a price on them. It was a dollar on the paper. Yeah. I was like, fuck, it's worth a dollar, even though it was 3 weeks old next to the fireplace. And I'd just walk around selling them and making coins. So, and then, you know, we had car wash out the front of our house for years, right? So, you know, on the weekends, you know, it was $3 a car and they'd just line the whole the street up and we would just wash everyone's cars and the kids would do it. You know, me and the neighborhood kids. And little did they know that the night before I was getting mum's vacuum cleaner bag and just covering every fucking car in the street in dust.
You're creating your own marketplace. That's, you know, that's genius.
And the golf club, they used to hit, like we used to just jump in all the dams and, you know, find all the golf balls, you know, because there's all creeks and shit around the golf course. So we'd just jump in there, buy all the golf balls and then just sell them to people. And then we just started going, hey, I've run out of finding golf balls. So we just taught the golden retriever, a friend's dog. We'd hide down there in the creek and, you know, as they hit the ball onto the green, you know, there was a curve and we would just set the dog to go out there, grab the ball, and then on the third hole after that we'd sell it back to them.
It seems to be a continuing theme here in your
dishonesty.
Business.
Dishonesty. Well, I was a shit kid. Like I was a, you know, like I would find the hustle, but I'd cross the line. But it wasn't until I had a, like at about 15, I was probably pretty close to getting booted out of school for graffiti and being a smart ass. And I had someone come to my school and run a workshop and change my life. And he became my mentor for up until he passed away from cancer about 6 years ago. He was just my guiding light and he invested in me and he said, there's something in there that you just haven't tapped into yet. And he saw things that I hadn't seen and he just worked with me until he sort of nurtured them out and showed, you know, put me on stage and just was just incredible. And just, you know, he'd nurture these things out, push me, you know, with terror in my eyes, stepping out of my comfort zone. And then everyone would praise it and go, you know, that was pretty good. And then he'd say, see? And I'd go, fuck, it's hard to deny. Yeah, that went okay. And then he just did that for years and years and years until, you know, I was sort of doing bigger and scarier stuff but feeling pretty comfortable with it.
What sort of things was he getting you to do?
Well, emceeing. So I'd be emceeing at, you know, 16 in front of 1,000 people. And he'd pair me with a celebrity at the time. And so I did that for years and then I'd go out to would go out to schools and do inspirational talks because he was a celebrity footballer. He came out from Ireland and he had the record for the most amount of consecutive games. He played every single game of football as the ruck, which is the most demanding role, through broken fingers and crook backs for 12 years every game, didn't miss one. And he won the Brownlow medal and then he started to pay it forward, but he was just this incredible teacher. And so his just outlook on life was just so profound that I just followed him around. So I'd wag most Wednesdays because that was sport and I'd learn how to, he taught me how to drive and I'd drive him 3 hours away while he did work and prepared for these inspirational talks to, you know, 300 people at Rotary Club. And so I used to go out there and sit behind him and just write word for word what he was doing, just mimic him, right? And then he would say, you know how to do that exercise, come out and stir him up. And so I'd do a little bit of an exercise and then I'd do a bit more of one and then he'd go, right, I'm now sitting in the back and you're doing it. And then I was just using his words and then after a while I would trial some stuff and go off piste and go, shit, that worked. And then I would start to integrate my own stuff. And then after a while, I was just doing all my own stuff. And then I was training, you know, 100 kids underneath me. And so he was just able to pay that forward, and you know, the Reach Foundation is what he created, and it's worked with, you know, hundreds of thousands of teenagers, and just, you know, given so much self-belief to kids that just wouldn't have it.
Was there a point when you what was it with him that made it different from, I mean, I presume there must have been teachers trying to sort of encourage.
Yeah, well, he wasn't a fuckwit. Like, honestly, he just, no, but, you know,
no, you're right, that's fair enough.
You've got a 15-year-old kid, you know, like, if you don't meet him at their level, you are missing the point.
Yeah.
Like, he came in and I was at the back with all my mates and I was just ripping, like, he was a celebrity guest talker, you know, like, guest speaker, and we used to make them cry. Like, we used to just sit there and just terrorize them, you know, like, and so he did this, but he was 10 foot tall, right? And so I just went, I don't care about this guy. And so I started to sabotage it. He then goes, right, you stand up, because the teacher is about to kick me out, as per usual. And so I stood up and he goes, what's your name? And I go, Rupert. And everyone laughs. And he goes, so who are you? And I said, I don't know, what do you mean? He's like, well, what do you want to do in your life? And I said, oh, I don't know. And he's like, well, it's pretty obvious. I mean, you're never going to know what you want to do in life unless you know who you are. You don't have a fucking idea. You know, look at you being all tough. And it was just like, he said, and yet you can lead all these kids in the back. So there's obviously something good in there. And so he sort of slapped me in the face with a pat on the back. And I turned up to this course and it just wasn't bullshit. Like, it was, we were in a room of 25 kids, some from detention centres, some living on the street, some, you know, drug addicted, some from a psychiatric unit, kids from really expensive private schools, and me, you know, and we all sat around and talked about what the fuck was going on in our life. And just that in itself was powerful. And it just built this thing in a time when there was no such thing as personal development. Like, that was like for the scouts or church, you know, there was no one was even remotely thinking about this stuff, and yet they did it with edge. And you couldn't do a lot of it today because it was full on. Like, they'd hang us off cliffs, and you know, we would push the boundaries of fear.
Yeah.
It was amazing. So that's what was different. You know, it was someone, and even today, you know, if you want to build rapport with someone, you just got to, if you're not authentic, you're just kidding yourself. There's not, you've got no chance.
Do you still do things today that scare you?
Everything. And that's my problem. Because what Jim taught me was just keep pushing, like, lean into the darkness. I fucking hate doing that, but yet all I do is that. Because the problem with that is the tension in your body. Like, it continually, and it, like, right now I'm in tension mode. Like, I've been like this for 3 years. Started my own business. We've got 60 people around the globe and we're trying to grow this thing fast and we're trying to get more investment and we think we can, you know, have a crack. I've got a vision and I reckon it's going to come true. I don't know if I'm going to be the one who owns the category, but I can see how all these, you know, these tectonic plates are moving and I reckon it's going to trigger something huge and I'm excited by it. Like, I'm driven because I go, what if? And then I get passionate. And they go, right, how do I do that? And then I'm really good in enrolling people. I'm like, guys, look at this. And everyone goes, yeah, let's jump on. And then I go, well, let's try and do this thing. And then before you know it, the goals are outside of our reach, which is the point of them. Everyone's relying on me because I've dragged them into it. Everyone else is struggling. Yeah. I'm pressuring them to get the best out of themselves. I'm disciplining myself, which is pretty brutal in my own head, expecting the same out of these other poor people who are coming along for the journey. And then when things don't go right or things aren't flying, then you've got to work harder. And then I'm trying to have, you know, I got two kids and a wife and I'm trying to be, you know, because Jim died in the end and he said, mate, don't get so busy making a living you forget to make a life. And he got, he was addicted to busyness. And he finally spent some money on himself. He bought a Porsche Cayenne because he was a great property developer. He's just so smart. And, you know, at 45, he finally spent some money on himself. And, you know, one of the tumors in his eye renders him pretty much blind. He can't fucking drive it a month later. And he's just like, my God, I've had all this money, I've had all this time, and now I'm dying. And it was just brutal. And so he's like, don't make the same mistake. And here I am making the same fucking mistake. But, you know, like, that's the problem because you go, I want to make the most of this life. You know, I want to, we're all given gifts. And as an opportunist, which I all think we are, you want to go, how high can I push that? But it just comes with enormous sacrifice. And so everything I do right now is too much. You know, like I go, what if we do that? And then it's just hard. Then you can make it work rather than just sitting back and enjoying life. It's funny.
How did you get yourself involved in the entertainment industry? What was the big break for you?
Well, I mean, Jim taught me how to be a TV presenter, and he was never one. Like, he just taught me how to move with a room and read the beats, and I was always an attention seeker. You know, like, I was always a show off, and I liked performance. And so, you know, through school, I loved design and art, and so that was, you know, it was all about photography, and a lot of the things that I'm doing today, you know, is just a genuine passion. I just love visually having an idea and then just going, look at that. So that was that. So I went into graphic design. I started studying that. Around the same time, we did a Reach course, and we went away with all these kids from the psychiatric unit, and they all tried to off themselves on this weekend. And I was thinking, how bad can life be? These young kids, girls, you know, at every opportunity, if we're not watching them, they'll run in front of a car, jump off a cliff. Like, it was intense. We were out of our depth. Yeah. But I just couldn't get beyond that. And so I then left graphic design and went, I want to work with teenagers. And I had a scholarship for hypnosis, you know, clinical hypnosis. And I want to learn more about that. But I was like fucking 19. I had no life experience. I had no right to be talking to anyone. So I said, I'm going to travel overseas. And so I went overseas for 8 months. And a lot of that I traveled by myself, you know, scaring the shit out of myself through Europe. And through that process through the States, me and my best friend just went to all the talk shows. Like, rather than going to theme parks, we just went, let's go to Ricky Lake. Let's go to Jerry Springer, Sally Jesse Raphael, Queen Latifah, Roseanne Barr, Tony Shaw, all these TV shows. And so we did. And when we were in the audience, we started hanging shit and asking questions and winning competitions. And Roseanne Barr sent me out on the street and paid me money to take photos of weirdos, and my mate one comment of the day on Ricky Lake. I proposed to a girl on Sally Jesse Raphael. Jerry Springer, I got in a fight with this male gigolo, and it was just, we just had a ball ride. And all the presenters were like, that was funny, right? Like, afterwards, they were going, that was, you know, Jerry Springer going, that was really funny. And so,
what's happening on the Jerry Springer episode that you sat in on?
I think.
Because that's a wild TV show.
I can't even explain it. These days, I couldn't have said what I said. There's no way. Like, it was it was offensive. It was this male gigolo was saying, six pack of beer, I could turn any of you gay, to the audience. And I just said, from the heterosexuals you home to please, you can stay over there with your STDs. Like, it was just because he was trying to steal some girl's boyfriend. You know, they were having this relationship, and I couldn't. Oh, it was a mess, right?
I missed that TV show. I really missed that TV show. Mate,
the amount of eps I watched at 22, eating living on toaster sandwiches, sitting there watching Jerry Springer in the middle of the day in my undies. Like, that was. But my point being that once I did that, I started to go, these guys are getting paid quite well for having a ball, right? And I watched them work it, you know, in between the ad breaks and stuff, these presenters. I was like, I reckon I could have a crack at that. And so I sort of came back, and very quickly Ed McGuire had given me an opportunity to do a kids show pilot. You know, there were 70 people auditioning for it, but, you know, like, I was match fit. And then I won a competition called 15 Days of Fame on radio. And then through radio, they gave me my own radio show. They said that went really well. And so I created the Reach Foundation, all the stuff that I was running out in school workshops. Because I was at this time, you know, I was running 10 workshops out in secondary schools a week doing life coaching, even though I was a kid. And so I just went.
I think that's a perfect person to be doing the coaching to some of the kids.
The teachers would shit themselves. I'd turn up with my hat backwards. I can imagine. Hat backwards, bleach blonde hair, nose ring, and just this bogan And then, but within literally within 20 minutes, I'd have 200 kids sitting in a circle in the dark, crying, apologizing to each other for being mean. And it was, the teachers would just go, like, you'd be year nine. And I would go in there and do this thing called a sensory, where I'd build rapport, talk about confidence, then I'd get them all to lie down and get them to imagine themselves, imagine someone in their class that's been victimized. And then I bring them all up and I go, I want you to just thank someone who's had your back in this environment. They thank each other, opens the door, and then I just go, who deserves an apology from you? And this changed lives. Like, I still have what are now fathers come up to me at petrol stations hugging me going, someone apologized to me. Sorry, I'm about to cry. You know, that age, a lot of people are bottomed out, and you don't need much. And people. And I said, I didn't do it, mate. You know, you just give kids aren't innately mean. Give them the opportunity that it's safe to be kind, and they just take it. And so, you know, for 10 years, we were able to create these environments where you just change lives, because people have no self-belief, and then a comment from someone they thought hated them or someone influential just flips their whole script. And it's still the best job I've ever had. And I spent 10 years traveling the globe for free in business class, you know, jumping out of planes and getting, you know, playing soccer with baby elephants and going through Africa and all that. And everyone said that was the dream job. And me and my stereo in the boot of my old Valiant driving to fucking out in the countryside, talking to kids was powerful. Yeah. And I'll get back to that once I make enough money just to be able to set up my family and pull my head out of my ass. I'd get generous again. But right now I'm a selfish prick.
Taps into that. That sort of leads me to one of the questions that I, another one of the ones that I wrote down before we started talking. Kids as influencers. Obviously, you're working in that space. What's your feeling? And you've got two daughters, have you?
Yeah, 8 and 5.
Yeah. How do you feel about that? How do you feel about the rise of that? People using their children, and I don't necessarily mean teenagers. I mean, you know, children.
God. We would have them in our community, but not that I would even know. I'm not right into it. The reason being is, like, we have a lot of content that features kids, you know, and it's a beautiful, it's stunning. These, you know, like, so it's the parents' account, and or it's the kids, and they're taking photos and they're featuring and stuff. But to actually, I think there's a real danger in. I just think it can distort things. I think appearing in photos is fine, but as soon as the kid has an idea of engagement and, you know, let's do that one, that's going to do better than that one, and, you know, make sure you do this. As soon as you start shifting everyday childish behavior for gain, if you disrupt it too much, it becomes a bit like a show parent. You know, it's a bit toddlers and tiaras. I think it can be toxic. And look, you know, no kid has ever benefited from being famous too early. Like, not a kid on the planet. Nah. It's just because it's unnatural and it's not fair. They're trying to figure out who the hell they are, and you're telling them, well, the world is telling them that they're special, and they ain't. They're a snotty little kid, and they should grow up as one of 30 in a class.
It's difficult when I see brands tapping into that sort of celebrity kid vein. It kind of feels certain brands probably don't have any alternative, because they're appealing to kids, so they need kids to demonstrate to other kids the benefits of their brand or their location or whatever it is. I think you said you got it spot on there. Is that no kid ever benefited from becoming famous too early? I think that's priceless.
I don't see it. Do you see that in Australia? Like, I wouldn't even know of one example of that.
I can think of one very famous PR lady who too. Uses her kids. I find a struggle.
Yeah, I think outside of that, it would drop off pretty quick. And I know exactly what you're talking about. And to be honest, I also know of the power, you know, like for brands, it's like it's dangerous because it's really powerful for brands. You know, like I know that particular case, and there were these, I think, Dora Explorer Reebok shoes, and, you know, sales just melted down as soon as they were featured. Yeah, it's interesting.
I'm just, obviously, I've got a lot, there's a lot of questions, and you and I could probably talk for a good couple of hours. I'm just a bit, you know, wary of your time as well. But I want to come a couple more questions back to influencer marketing, because that's where your brain and skills are at the moment. One of the questions that I get asked a lot is that a lot of people perceive that influencer marketing just for that commercial B2C marketplace. Is there still an opportunity for B2B businesses to be using influencers?
At times. And I get this question at the end of every presentation at conferences. And it just all depends. The short answer is it may not. It just may not work. And right. The reason being is what you're purchasing is access to an influencer's audience. Now, that audience is varied. If, say, for instance, Earthwool, a client of yours, which is insulation in the walls, et cetera, and, you know, like, if they were trying to appeal to retailers, or if a recruiter was trying to appeal to businesses, you're going to have to assume that the influencer's audience is relevant to that. And no one has collected a concentrated group of retailers or a concentrated group of decision makers within businesses that might need a recruiter. You know, so it's just about the audience you're accessing. And so I think it works for lifestyle products, because you've got to understand why people are following them in Instagram in the first place. And no one follows someone on Instagram for tips on recruiters or tips on the property market. But it just doesn't work that way. It is a visual medium that broadcasts aspirational images, aspiration, and it's an aspirational lifestyle. So yes, you know, we deal a lot with banks, and everyone goes, how? I'll say, because banks get people's finances in order and are the champions that enable these influencers to have the lifestyles that they're celebrating. You know, whether they're traveling overseas or they've just done a beautiful renovation, like, that makes sense. That's what you—that's what money's for. You're not taking photos of your bank statement, right?
Yeah.
So you know, like, they're using the NAB travel app, you know, and that is amazingly perfect for influencer marketing. But B2B can be tricky. But where it works unbelievably well is because Instagram isn't good for. It's not great for performance marketing. Why? Well, actually, I will say this. Influencer marketing is not performance marketing. And the reason influencer marketing is not performance marketing is because the majority of it is built on Instagram, and Instagram does not allow you to create URLs. You either have to ram the path to purchase through your link in bio, or you have to say, go to my Insta stories, and then, you know, those with over 10,000 followers get to put a URL. Like, it is painful. Mm. There's no button there unless you're doing advertising, in which case it's unbelievably powerful. Learn more, click here. But organic influencer marketing doesn't connect those two dots. And not only that, but consumer behavior is not to go into Instagram and purchase things. Consumer behavior is to go in there and be inspired, to learn, to understand about a brand, to keep its brand awareness. It's not click-through attribution. But that doesn't mean influencer marketing can't become performance marketing. And where it comes into play, which is incredibly powerful, is in user-generated content performs 6.9 times better in Facebook than brand-generated content, right? The reason being is because when you're scrolling your feed in 1.5 seconds, you see an image. It looks a bit raw, authentic, doesn't look like this polished brand ad. You stop. You think, is this my friend? And just that moment in time attracts such high growth, you know, and we see that through all of our content because people run influencer marketing campaigns through us, like the Unilever example for Omo. And then, you know, 50 pieces go out in social. They can see the top five highest performing pieces of content that have over-engaged based on the creative. Then they can purchase that content, the content rights, and then they can put that into advertising. So they can put that into billboards. They can put that back into Instagram ads. Now you are actually targeting a precise audience with Facebook filters. And that targeting is amazing. So B2B is easily fixed. You go, I need a photo of the guys who have just won the block or House Rules, and I want them to take an awesome piece of content that celebrates it, right? And then I want to put it into Facebook, and I want to pick retailers. I want to pick Sydney. I want to pick, you know, people that like the Bunnings page. I want to pick, you can find your audience there. That is a hell of a lot more of a sophisticated tool than just going, that influencer's got 100,000 people. I wonder how many are relevant. You pay for the relevance, and that you cannot beat. And so what's more is not only can you buy that content that is personalized, performs better, you can pick the audience, but you could also add the click-through, learn more, buy now, shop now, and now it's performance marketing. And that's the left-right hook. Influencer marketing can take you to a point. It's powerful. It's great for market research. It's great for authenticity. It's great for generating high volumes of content. But it stops. Now take it and turn this thing into an absolute weapon.
Yeah. I think the interesting thing with B2B marketing is that those, you know, if you're targeting CEOs or CMOs or CIOs or whatever, that's C-suite or senior managers or anything like that, those people are often on these channels. They're on Facebook, they're on Instagram, they're on Twitter, but it just doesn't necessarily say, hi, I'm a CEO in their profile. It's just about trying to work out, as you've said, what content's right for them? What are they interested in reading or watching or all those kind of things, and putting that content out there? And I think to a degree, sometimes they'll find it because they're looking for it.
Like, actually, it's a bloody good point, mate. Like, you think the Gruen, you think about Gruen, right? So Gruen, who's liking that page? Who's following the socials of Gruen? Yeah. Industry professionals. Yeah. That is a niche community. So if you want a lookalike audience or you want to target them, I mean, you can go into Facebook right now and say, I want to send my ads to everyone who's liked the Gruen page. Because like that is phenomenal. I want everyone that likes Ad News page or, you know, whatever industry that you choose. Absolutely. And it's going to be hard to beat Google and Facebook. I just think Facebook is going to be the layer for all advertising in the future. Yeah. Like, you just can't beat the data. Like, you cannot beat the ability to pick exactly what you need. And it's bloody underpriced. But yet it's already gone, you know, like it's gone through the roof since like this year, I think.
Yeah.
In the first 3 months it went up 43%. Why? Because Zuckerberg said, right, we're going to minimize all the branded organic content in the feed, and we're just going to sort of remove that because we want more meaningful connections with users and their family and friends, which forces everyone to do advertising now. Yeah. And if they're all going to do advertising, it's going to be competitive. And it's going to cost more, which means you're going to want to perform. If you want to perform, you've got to get the creative right. If you want to get the creative right, you have to have a variety, as I said earlier, a volume, and you have to nail the creative formats. And so that's the problem. So where everyone is going to keep pushing towards that, they're all going to hit that bottleneck.
My last three questions for you today, because again, we could talk for hours, but you know, whether anyone will listen to us for an hours is another matter entirely. I normally ask people about what brands people like. That's my normal third to last question, but I'm going to ask you a different question. Aside from your mentor, who you've mentioned earlier, who influences you today?
Mark Burris, I really gained confidence from him. So for those who don't know and those listening from overseas, he is one of our greatest business brains. He was a disruptor in the home loans environment, went up against the big banks, sold that for half a billion dollars, and then he was the head honcho on the Celebrity Apprentice Australia, and now he's created something called The Mentor and this whole platform around mentored for small businesses. And so there's a TV show, a series. So I featured on one of the episodes a little while ago with Tribe. Yeah. And just being around Mark Bruce, because what I love about him, he's rough around the edges. He's a he's a true blue fighting. He has the Aussie spirit. He's a boxer. Like he's in his 50s and he's just charismatic, but he's just not polished and he just gets shit done. And he just he calls a spade and I love – and but yet he's got a big heart and he cares. And I just think that his platform, which is him and all the digital platforms and what he'll build around him is just going to be so incredibly powerful. And so that inspires me because I've never done – like I shouldn't even be in this. Like I've never – I've got a tech marketing tech company. I've never run a company. I've never studied marketing and I have no idea about tech. You know, and that when I see people like that, I just go grit and street smarts can do plenty, and so that gives me inspiration. And I see a lot of successful people around the world. I just like courage. You know, fearlessness is something very attractive, but it's all bullshit because no one. I don't like people who are fearless. I like people who are scared shitless and do it anyway. Yeah. Like that's what I love. You know, that's an attractive quality. Fearlessness, you're just a flog mouthing off, yeah. I reckon.
It's funny, I was listening to a podcast, we spoke about it earlier, Tim Ferriss, one of his podcasts, his latest one with a lady called Cindy Whitehead, and she's grown and sold a lot of pharma companies in the US. And she started a pharma company based on selling male testosterone implants, things like that. And
where do I get them? I need some checks.
She said she started that with no pharma experience whatsoever, no business experience, nothing. But she saw the gap and her solution was surround yourself with people who do know those things. Yeah. You know, you don't have to know all those things. You just have to have people working with you and around you that do know those things so that they can help you and teach you. So, you know, I don't think you need to know about tech. You'd have to have passionate and be, you know, and be a leader just, you know, just as long as you've got the right people around you.
Absolutely. And I'm surrounded with smart people, superstars. You know, I'm very, very lucky. But as soon as I said earlier, I enroll them, I owe them. And I'd want to be pretty right on my vision, which luckily I feel like I am. I'm convinced of what we're working towards, but you know, I do have those doubts. You know, are we too early? Is it too ambitious? Just so many, you know, so many doubts. That's the tension of being entrepreneurial, and I think we all feel that. We all have our tension in our life, and it can distract us. You know, my conflict is like what Jim Stein's imparted in his final days, you know, don't be addicted to being busy. And it's a strange conundrum. You know, he also said make the most of life. And how I interpret that is by pushing myself to my limits, but it might be just actually to like sitting down and having a, you know, better conversation and being more present around my family and friends.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it's an interesting area, but we all face those.
It's a definite challenge. And, mate, in terms of you're sort of sitting there saying, oh, are we too early? I look at, you know, anyone who gets the chance to go to tribegroup.co, you look at the case studies that you've got on there. And I think when you look at some of the brands that you've been working with, I don't think there's any question about you being too early. I think you're right on the money. Anyone who's worked with Guzman and Gomez is a fan of mine. Anyone who knows me knows that I eat there about three times a week.
It's a problem, isn't it, with Mexican? Because when I'm in London, my London team laugh at me because whenever they say, what do you want to eat? I go Mexican. I have no issue eating Mexican every day. I'll eat it for breakfast, lunch or dinner because it fits for all of them. Like you can have a brekkie wrap. I'm stuck in that. I reckon I'm I'm in trouble. I'm an addict too.
Mate, I posted this on Facebook the other week, but my son turned 2 yesterday, and 2 weekends ago, we're driving around a roundabout near where we live, and he can't even see where the Guzman and Gomez is from that roundabout, but he knows it's there, and he's shouting out in the back of the car, Beto, 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 which is obviously his short version of burrito. So I've now trained him to know where the Guzman and Gomez is near where we live. So that anytime we're there, that's the reaction I get from the back of the car. So,
you know, in terms of inspiration, Stephen Marks, who's the founder, and he's been running that for 10 years and working his little ring off, American guy who's charismatic. And then he's got Lara Tom, who is the CMO there. And
I've been trying to get Lara on this show.
One of her siblings. In her family, there's 5 of them, I think, and I think 4 of them are in marketing. They're CMOs and they're all hilarious. Wow. I think her mum was the one who said, oh, great, so I've raised a bunch of bullshitters. But she's unreal, and Stephen is powerful. Like, if you ever have a chance to go onto the Guzman and Gomez, like, just find out their content marketing and the sort of the risks that they take. They're a perfect one. You know, you didn't ask the question about brands. Guzman and also Vino Mofo. Just have a
I've interviewed Justin from Vino Mofo. That he was one of my very first early ones, mate. Yeah. That's the brand story there is fantastic.
But just have some balls. So this is our personality. Put it out there. Don't play it too safe. And people, it resonates with people. And that's that authenticity piece that I'm talking about. Yeah. Like, for a brand to be authentic, for Mark Brewers to be authentically him, I think that's really inspiring. And I think, you know, I know it seems odd with influencer marketing because authenticity comes under the microscope because they're paid for it. But I tell you what, all of these content creators have crafted a community on authenticity, right? They were crafting content and giving it for free and inspiring their audience for 5 or 6 years before there was an option to make a cent out of it. And what they still do is maintain that. And you get, you know, when you influence someone, you get the advocacy for free. What you're paying for is for someone to take the time to craft some stunning content for you, you know. And it's I reckon that's why people don't unfollow influencers when they post a sponsored post, because all of them say hashtag ad. But at micro influencer level, those audiences go, hey, I like this person. If they're making a bit of money, I'm cool with that.
Yeah, back to the Guzman and Gomez story. Years and years ago when they first started, we won a Guzman and Gomez competition online. This was my agency. We'd only been running it for about a year, and they sent the whole agency. I mean, bear in mind there was only 4 or 5 of us, but they sent us all Guzman and Gomez hoodies, and we spent the whole afternoon taking photos of ourselves in our Guzman and Gomez hoodies and posted them everywhere. So
brilliant!
It cost them 5 hoodies and some postage.
And I've got a Guzman and Gomez skateboard sitting in our office.
Oh, okay.
I kid you not.
You've upped me. You've upped me with my hoodie and your skateboard. Mate, last question. What's the plan for Tribe this year? What have you got? What have you got lined up for the rest of the year?
So, as I said, what's unique about our platform is that there's no barrier to entry, and you actually put a brief in there, and within days, your own customers go out and purchase your product if they don't already have it at home. They craft content and they submit it to you up front as a pitch. So effectively, you go through this inbox. If you like it, you buy it. If you don't, you don't. And so it's complete reverse on every other model around the planet. So if Nutella wants 50 pieces of content, they go to another platform, they get 50 pieces of content generated. In ours, they choose 50 out of 200. So brands started to say, hey, I declined the other 150 because the influencers wasn't right, their engagement, their feed. But that piece of content is mind-blowingly good. Like, that is so on brand. Can I just purchase that content, put it in our social ads or put it in our billboard or print or whatever? And so we started selling the content rights of it. Then people were coming to us and saying, hey, I don't even need the influencer. Can I just have content? So what we've created are content-only campaigns where it's like a stock image library but on demand and shot to your specification. And like having 100, you know, photographers come to your wedding, but you only pay for the pics you love. And the influencers actually love it because they're making heaps of money taking photos on their phone, and we're paid out like $7 million. So that's what we're playing with. It's like, who are those gutsy brands that actually just want 10 or 20 pieces of content that they can use in their advertising that want to actually empower their own customers to generate that? And why I say I sometimes think we're too early is because if I go to, like, Cadbury got 350 pieces of content in, you know, in a few days. If I go to Cadbury, mate, here's 350 pieces of content, what do you want to do with it? That scares the hell out of them. Yeah. Like, they don't, no one really has the systems to be able to shove 300 pieces of content into a machine. Like, you need a growth marketer, a performance marketer, right? So the world hasn't caught up. We're now selling pieces that are 10, 20, 30, 40. But in the future, we'll have this machine that can produce 100, 1,000, 2,000, right? So that's what I mean. Like, we're early in the piece. People don't want 100 pieces of content, even though they need it, because it's like we give them the fuel, but they need the car. You know, they need the whole system to take, you know, to use it. So that's our focus, and we're pretty excited by it.
Mate, it has been an absolute pleasure. And as I've said a couple of times before, you and I can go on and talk for hours here.
But yeah. I'm sorry, mate. No, you asked a question and I rattle on for 20
minutes. Well, maybe we'll do this again in, you know, 3 to 6 months' time and you know, and get more ideas about, you know, and get more specific about some of the stuff you're doing. But, mate, thank you very much. If anybody wants to get in contact with you, what's the best place to talk to you?
Do you know, I mean, you can hit us up through tribegroup.co, but if there was one thing that you should have a look at, it's going to Instagram and type in @tribe.content. And you'll see a few hundred case studies there of the content quality. And I just reckon that I hope makes you go, wow, like the quality of the content is amazing, and the brands using it. Like, we've worked with, you know, 7,000 brands. It's just beautiful. Like, I'm just so inspired, like as a designer. I'm just so inspired by everyday people just being able to just wow the hell out of me.
Mate, good luck putting your presentation together this afternoon.
Thanks, mate.
You know, rock out the old Paint Shop Pro if you can't.
Gosh. And my favourite font, Mistral.
No, Comic Sans, mate. Comic Sans.
Oh, Cooper. What about Cooper?
Yeah. It's been a pleasure, mate. Thank you very much for your time today.
No worries. Thanks, Simon. That was excellent.
And that is it. Thank you very much once again for tuning in to episode 26. We appreciate you tuning in to each and every episode. And we really appreciate you subscribing or listening or sharing whatever it is that you do out there. Please, again, if you're on iTunes, give us a rating and a review. Otherwise, we look forward to seeing you all next week. Thank you.